Friends of Nexus, welcome back. It's season 12. I'm so excited to have you here with us online. I hope you've had a very refreshing summer and are ready to get back into the routines of fall. And some of us are, of course, going to be meeting at the Conrad Center this morning, but we are not out of the woods yet with this pandemic, this plague. And so we're remaining online because we know some of us will be more comfortable online, or some of us are tuning in from far away. So welcome. We're so glad that you're joining us again for another season here at Nexus. And every season, I come up with some sort of little tagline for the season. This year, season 12 at Nexus, I'm calling A Hitchhiker's Guide to the Cosmos for Wondering Hearts. And I borrowed that phrase, I love it, from James K. Smith. But I love that, and we'll get into that a little bit later in the fall. But the leadership team here at Nexus thought, you know what, after 18 months of being in this sort of liminal space, the pandemic, that this fall might be a great time for us to revisit what Nexus is all about, do a refresher, you could say, on who we are. And so for those of you who have been traveling with us for 11 years now, this will serve as a refresher. For those of you maybe just joining us or have joined us recently and might be wondering, what is this church all about? Well, these first few weeks of season 12 are going to be about that. To begin, the first thing that's important to know about Nexus is that we are a practice-driven church as opposed to a belief-centered church. And I'll explain more about our practices in the next few weeks and what that looks like, how we rally around or are striving to rally around these collective practices. But behind everything we do at Nexus is something we call our path and our passion. And these two things, our path at Nexus and our passion at Nexus, drive everything that we do. They inform all of our practices. And so I thought this week we would start with that. So what exactly is Nexus's path? Well, let me read it to you. Our path, this is what binds us. At Nexus, we are pursuing the way and path of Jesus. We understand the teachings, stories, events, life, death, and resurrection of Jesus to be the path of life. It's the way of justice and mercy, love and grace, reconciliation and redemption, death and resurrection, and the never-ending quest to become more fully and authentically human. We are committed to pursuing, exploring, learning from, and following the Jesus path. Now, I feel like I talk about this a lot at Nexus. You see, for us, I believe the best way to understand the Christian faith is to actually see it as a path, a way of life, something to follow. So suffice it to say, I don't want to belabor this point because you'll hear this from me often at Nexus. What I want to concentrate on this morning actually is our passion here at Nexus. And this is what our passion says. Our passion, this is our driving ethos. Nexus exists to present a compelling expression of the Christian path. We understand that for many, life can feel difficult and confusing. Faith can feel stale and loaded with baggage. Nexus exists for the restless and the weary, the curious and confused, for the disillusioned and for those looking for more, for those about done with faith and those eager to explore. Nexus is passionate about exploring the Jesus path in honest and meaningful ways. Let me concentrate on that first line for a moment. Nexus exists to present a compelling expression of the Christian path. And why is that? Well, I think for many, the reality is this. A lot of expressions of the Christian faith feel anything but life-giving. They feel loaded with baggage. They feel sort of stale. The opposite of compelling, you could say. And my primary mission, Nexus's primary mission, is to try to talk about Jesus in a way that is as compelling as possible. You know, I've been reading through the Gospels lately, and one of the things that really strikes me about the stories we find there is that people desperately sought out Jesus. They were very audacious, you could say, in their efforts just to get close to him, just to be close to his presence. And I think when you read the Gospels, what you come to find is this, is for the people trying to get close to Jesus, they sensed in him this power, this life force, you could say, that was unlike anything they'd ever experienced. And if you read the Gospels story after story, it's just telling us all of these tales about people desperate to get close to Jesus. I mean, have you ever seen someone with a look of desperation in their eye? Friends, I have to tell you, my wife, Kristen, God bless her beautiful soul, she's a bit hard to travel with. She's a bit high maintenance when on the road, you could say, and it's of no fault of her own. She struggles with motion sickness, but this is, in our history together, created all sorts of problems because we're on a bus, she always has to sit at the front. If she's in the back seat, she feels queasy. A train, subway, all of that stuff makes her stomach. And so it can be a bit daunting, a bit challenging traveling with her. You always got to find the right position, and planes, more than anything, make her feel very sick. And so she's developed this sort of habit, this routine. When we're about to board a plane, right, as they call you up, hey, everybody boarding, what she'll do is she'll pop to gravel. And by the time the flight takes off, usually she's just sort of in a bit of a haze, falls asleep, keeps everything calm down in the stomach department, all good. But I remember a few years ago, we were about to hop on a plane and the sound came, hey, everybody get on the plane, that sort of thing. We're standing in line and she goes to pop in her gravel and suddenly this wild-eyed look of desperation comes over her face. She looks down and realizes in her little travel case there, she's out of gravel. She doesn't have any. And for her, this was like a state of emergency. She wasn't about to get on that plane without gravel because it would mean, it wasn't going to be pretty for the rest of the passengers. And so she looks at me with this just desperation in her eye, as in, do something. Of course, being the loving husband that I am, I immediately jump into action. I dart for the closest little convenience store in the airport. And I tell you, I'm ducking and weaving, bobbing and maneuvering around people. I just took off in a mad dash. I had to find her gravel. And of course, we're on some alleyway in the airport. So it's a bit of a distance, but I sprint. Finally, I get to a store, I grab the gravel, pay the money. I get back, right as it's like final boarding call. Oh. They saved the day. Kristen pops her two gravel. We're off to the races, it would seem, but about 30 minutes into the flight, Kristen's getting antsy. She's sort of wigging out, you could say. So she starts complaining a lot. Oh my goodness, I'm so uncomfortable, Brad. And it seems to be getting worse. And I'm trying to be sympathetic. It's okay, honey, it's okay. I know you don't like flying, but we're doing it. We're on top of it. But it keeps getting worse and worse. She's like, I feel like I'm crawling out of my skin, Brad. I don't know what's happening. I can't do this. I just... And she's just going on and on. This is like a 3-4 hour flight. And you know, my sympathy, it waned, I gotta be honest. Now, I didn't say anything in the moment, but in my head, you know, I'm sort of thinking, listen, nobody likes traveling, okay? We're all suffering here. I know you're not comfortable, but nobody else is. So let's try to keep it to a low roar, right? So, you know, I'm not being exactly nice. She's just, again, wigging out, but we land. No harm, no foul. Never thought anything of it again until 6 months later, my parents had decided to take the whole family to Cuba. We were going on an all-inclusive vacation to Cuba. Same thing, get to the airport. We're right at the gate about to board the airplane. And Kristen goes to retrieve her travel gravel, and she looks at it, and suddenly her eyes change temperament. They're no longer filled with desperation, you could say. They're filled with a sort of anger. And looking at the gravel, she suddenly shoves it into my chest and says to me, read the directions on the gravel, Brad. I'm like, what is going on here? So I look down at the gravel, I read the directions. Adults, unwrap and insert one suppository into the rectum every 6 to 8 hours. And Kristen's glaring at me at this point. And I said to her, I don't think you're supposed to take these orally, honey. And she said, you figure? That's why I was wigging out on the plane a few months ago. And I'm like, oh my goodness, I'm sorry, honey. And then I was like, hey, well, at least I got you the comfort shape suppository. She didn't seem to find that too funny. But then in that moment again, she's desperate. She can't take these. She needs new gravel. And once again, dash off through the airport, get the gravel, read the instructions carefully, voila, problem solved. But I had fed my wife suppositories. I guess the moral of the story is this. When buying gravel, friends, be sure to read the label carefully. Rather, the point of the story to me is this, is when we are desperate because we know we're feeling unwell and we want to feel alive and have vitality, there's a desperation there. And sometimes we can be desperate in our attempts to find health, to find life, to find vitality. And I think what's interesting in the Gospels is that we find this wherever Jesus seems to go is there's desperation everywhere. Everywhere Jesus went, it seemed to prompt this desperate reaction. I must get close to him. He is the author of life. He is the one who can heal. He has the power of life. I mean, consider this story, one of many, but consider this particular story from the Gospel of Mark. A large crowd followed and pressed around him. In Luke's account, it actually says the crowds almost crushed him. And a woman was there who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years. She had suffered a great deal under the care of many doctors and had spent all she had, yet instead of getting better, she grew worse. When she heard about Jesus, she came up behind him in the crowd and touched his cloak because she thought, if I just touch his clothes, I will be healed. Immediately, her bleeding stopped and she felt in her body that she was freed from her suffering. At once, Jesus realized that power had gone out from him. He turned around in the crowd and asked, who touched my clothes? You see people crowding against you, his disciples answered, and yet you can ask, who touched me? But Jesus kept looking around to see who had done it. Then the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came and fell at his feet and, trembling with fear, told him the whole truth. And he said to her, daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace and be freed from your suffering. One woman, desperate for healing, desperate for the touch of life, desperate to just touch, just get close enough to the one she senses has the power, holds the power of life and healing and vitality. She pushes her way through this crowd. I can just imagine her wrestling through, trying to sneak her way up to Jesus, and then she's healed. All it took was just a touch. And this is hardly a lone example. In the Gospels, stories like these litter the pages of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Everywhere Jesus went, people looking to him, trying to get close to him, crying out to him, scrambling through the crowds to get close to him. And why? Because they all sensed, they all knew, this guy has the power of life. Monday, August 23rd of this year, just 3 weeks ago, a man named Kirk Johnson finds himself on the phone with a man named Ajmal. And Ajmal is in a canal, knee-deep in water, outside of the airport in Kabul, Afghanistan. You see, Kirk is the founder of the LIST Project. Kirk worked for many years in Iraq, employed by the U.S. to do reconstruction work after the country had sort of fallen apart. And so after he returned home, he decided to start this LIST project as a way to help settle Iraqis and people from Afghanistan whose lives were in danger because of their affiliation with the United States or their allies. And as you can imagine, over the past few weeks, as the occupation of Afghanistan has come to a close, Kirk and his team have been incredibly busy. But before August 23rd, Kirk and his team, they had never known Ajmal. They'd never, in fact, ever talked to Ajmal. But on this night, Kirk was called to help Ajmal and his family escape from Afghanistan. You see, Ajmal had worked for an NGO in Afghanistan that was funded by the United States. And now that the Taliban had taken over Kabul, he needed to get himself, his brother, and his parents out of Afghanistan as quickly as possible. Of course, the problem, as we all saw watching on TV, is that the airport in Kabul was completely covered and swarmed by masses of desperate people trying to get out of the country. The airport was a chaotic scene of desperation and danger. In fact, Ajmal had tried to head to the airport just days after the city fell, but the chaotic scene there was so overwhelming to him that it actually prompted a severe panic attack. In fact, it was so bad he had to be hospitalized. The feat of getting to the airport and somehow getting out of the country seemed like an impossible task to Ajmal, and yet the life of his brother and his ailing sick parents depended on him. And so Ajmal was in this uncertain situation. What does he supposed to do? And yet Ajmal and his family had one advantage that many of the other people swarming the airport didn't have. You see, Ajmal and his family were dual citizens. They're citizens of both Afghanistan and Canada. Getting to the airport was their best hope of escaping, but Ajmal's mother was ill and feeble. He thought the bedlam at the airport was just too risky to take that chance, and so he had decided after his panic attack that his family would just stay put, just stay where they were and hope things calmed at the airport or that Canadians might reach out to them and rescue them in some way. But of course, things weren't about to calm down. Things were only about to get worse. At 3:01 a.m. on August 23rd, Ajmal received an email from the Canadian government that simply read this. Important instructions. Go to the Baron Hotel immediately. Do not wear Western-style clothing. Be prepared to wait for many hours. Once inside, go to the garden and sit under the Canadian flag and wait for Canadian officials. Bring food and water if possible. For Canadians in Afghanistan on August 23rd, this was the process for leaving, for getting out of the country. Get to some hotel garden and sit under a flag. Bring food and water because you're going to be waiting a long time. Ajmal wasn't actually sure that his parents could actually make it, but at this point he's desperate, and this seems like a dangerous situation. They're being told to get out immediately, and so they would have to take the risk. And so, frightened, he quickly gathers up his family and they begin heading to the Baron Hotel, but when they arrive there, they realize there's nothing there. There's no Canadians to be found anywhere. The directions to the Baron Hotel had left them nowhere. And in their defense, I actually did a Google search this week. If you type in the Baron Hotel in Kabul, what you find is it directs you to an empty field. Ajmal and his family were lost. No idea where to go, desperate to get out of the country. And this is where Kirk comes into the story, because you see, Ajmal's family back home in Canada had gotten in contact with him, asked if he would help Ajmal and the family escape to safety. And so Kirk, he starts texting with Ajmal, and he sends them a detailed description of how they can actually get to the Baron Hotel. But directions in hand, they start heading to the right location now, but they end up at the back of a mushrooming crowd of thousands of Afghanis looking to get out of the country. They can't get anywhere close to where they're supposed to be. The crowd is massive, and there at the very back, Ajmal with his brother and his two ailing parents. And so Ajmal and his family are at the back of the crowd, and Ajmal strains his neck trying to see what's causing the commotion, what's holding things up. And what he can see is that everyone in that massive crowd is vying for the attention of one single person. A lone Canadian soldier has been tasked with monitoring that area's access to the airport. Now, I need to tell you something about Ajmal's character at this point, because you have to know that Ajmal is a very shy and mild-mannered man. I mean, he's a rule follower. He's cautious. He doesn't like to interrupt things. He doesn't like to bend the rules. In fact, throughout this whole process, while they're trying to escape, the whole time he's wearing a mask under his chin. In the event he ends up inside, he can use it to protect himself and follow the COVID protocols. This guy follows the rules. He's shy, he's cautious. And the week before, he just had a severe panic attack. He's standing at the back of the crowd thinking, my goodness, there's no hope. There's no way to get out. And so Ajmal looks at this situation. There's no way he can get the attention of that lone Canadian soldier. There's no way he can even get close to him. He texts Kirk and tells him, there's no hope. There's no way. And this is when Kirk decides to actually get on the phone with Ajmal. He calls him up, and they end up on the phone together for over 6 hours. And what Kirk tells Ajmal is this: listen, I know this is difficult, but you have to get to the front of the crowd. You simply have to. Ajmal, whatever courage you have, whatever courage you can muster, you're going to have to get to the front of the pack. And so the two, they devise a plan. He tells Ajmal this, somehow you're going to have to snake your way through the crowd. Push, try to sneak your way through, dodge, whatever you have to do, get to the front of the crowd. And when you get there, I want you to crawl down the embankment into a canal that's separating the Canadian soldier from the massive crowd. Ajmal, you can do it. You have to go there now. This is the time to leave. And that's exactly what Ajmal does. He takes a deep breath, he musters all of his courage, and he slinks his way through the crowd slowly. In fact, it takes him hours, but he finally manages to get to the front of the crowd. And then he crawls down to the embankment and finds himself standing in water that's up to his knees. On the one side of him on the embankment is a crowd of thousands, all yelling, trying to get the attention of the one lone Canadian soldier that stands on the other side of the embankment. Ajmal is now in the middle of them, trying to get the attention of the Canadian soldier, waving his passport, waving his papers, all in an effort to get that Canadian soldier just to notice him. But the crowds are loud and chaotic. And Kirk recorded this phone call. It took over 6 hours, this phone call. 6 hours of Ajmal in this canal trying to figure out what is he going to do as Kirk tries to coach him on. And in the recording of the phone call, you can listen to it. It's actually chaotic. It's very hard to listen to. There's voices of desperation all around him. But Kirk knows this. Ajmal is already at his breaking point. He's already pushed himself incredibly far. He's already had a panic attack a few days ago. He has to be delicate with Ajmal. He knows he can't push him too hard, but he knows this. Ajmal must get close to the Canadian soldier. He must get his attention. That Canadian soldier is the salvation of Ajmal and his family. That Canadian soldier is their lifeline. And so Kirk is on the phone with Ajmal, trying to coach him, trying to coax him into getting the attention. You can hear in their conversation the desperation in both their voices. Ajmal, can you hear me? You aren't going to get the attention of the soldier just by standing in the canal. You're going to have to shout to him, Ajmal. Can you shout to him, Ajmal? And Ajmal, he asks Kirk, well, do you know the soldier's name? And Kirk is like, no, of course I don't know his name, Ajmal. You're going to have to shout. You're going to have to get his attention. And you can hear Ajmal on the phone, Canada, Canada, in his broken English, doing what he can to get a hold of that lone Canadian soldier. And Kirk's coaching him on, louder, Ajmal, Canada, Canada. It's not working. What is going on, Ajmal? Tell me what's going on. And Ajmal's like, well, he's walking away. He's walking away now. And so Kirk is like, okay, try this, Ajmal. Try this. I want you to tell the Canadian soldier, scream out to him that you're on the phone with a friend of a Canadian minister. Kirk, of course, is vaguely connected with a Canadian minister of economic development, Melanie Joly. And Kirk is desperate here. He doesn't know her that well, but if name dropping is going to help, then so be it. And so he's telling him, tell, scream out, you're on the phone with a friend of a Canadian minister. And Ajmal tries that, but again, his broken English is making his cries not very compelling. A friend of a Canadian minister. It's getting nowhere. Nobody's paying attention to them. And the whole conversation, you can hear Kirk, he's swearing and sighing under his breath because he knows he's not helping Ajmal. They're getting nowhere. They're going to have to do something else. At points, there's silences in the conversation. You can hear Kirk saying, well, what's going on, Ajmal? And frequently he'll respond with, well, the soldier's talking to somebody else, so I'm just trying to wait my turn. And listening to it as a listener, it's frustrating because you're like, I think there are many of us who would have no problem in this situation, just bellowing at the top of our lungs, being very invasive to get the attention of the soldier. But again, Ajmal's very polite. He's shy. He's mild-mannered. And yet he knows his life, his brother's life, his parents' lives are all depending on him. He has to get the attention of that lone Canadian soldier. He has to in order to find life, to spare their lives. And Kirk at this point is not sure that Ajmal actually has it in him. Ajmal keeps yelling, Canada! Canada! But he's getting nowhere. You can almost hear the sound of defeat in Ajmal's voice. At one point, Ajmal asks Kirk, is there any other way? He suggests to Kirk that maybe they would go home as a family and wait for another day, try again tomorrow, or maybe they'd wait and Canada would come and rescue them. And Kirk knows at the moment that as Ajmal is considering other options, he knows that he has to push Ajmal, even if it might break him. Ajmal, he says to him, the Canadians, you have to understand, Ajmal, the Canadians are not coming to get you, and there is no other day. It has to be now. It has to be now, Ajmal. This is the best chance you've got. When the Canadian soldier gets closer, he pleads with Ajmal, you have to get his attention. Almost weeping now, Ajmal says, okay, he's gonna try. He's gonna wait for the Canadian soldier to get closer, and then he's going to try again. And finally, in the distance, he sees the Canadian soldier patrolling back closer to him, and he starts again, Canada! Canada! And this is going on, and finally Kirk is like, this isn't going to work. Canada! Canada! He's trying louder, but Kirk is like, no, Ajmal, listen, you have to repeat exactly after me, okay? Repeat exactly as I say. You have to yell out, I am a Canadian citizen. Do you hear me, Ajmal? Can you do that? Repeat after me. I am a Canadian citizen. You have to yell, I am a Canadian citizen. Ajmal agrees and starts crying that out. Canadian citizen! Canadian citizen! Louder, Ajmal, it has to be louder. Canadian citizen! Canadian citizen! And nothing's working, and you can hear Ajmal getting desperate, crying on the phone. He's going the other way, Kirk, he's going the other way. And Kirk's coaching him on, louder, you have to shout it, get his attention. Canadian citizen! Canadian citizen! Louder, more! Canadian citizen! Canadian citizen! Canadian citizen! Canadian citizen! There's a silence on the phone. And then, a voice. Who is this? Ajmal had done it. And now it was Kirk's turn. Very quickly, he responds, you have four Canadian citizens with you, and Minister Melanie Joly needs them to be processed right away. Can you assure that? Soldier says, it is chaos here, but we'll get them processed. I promise we'll get them processed. Ajmal had done it. He had made it through to the Canadian, to the one person who could save him and give him life. He was going to be processed. And it's at that moment that the phone call ends. And hours later, Kirk hasn't heard back from Ajmal. He texts him, no response. He tries calling him, no response. He waits 2 hours, then 10 hours, then 15 hours. 24 hours, he can't get a hold of Ajmal. 36 hours later, a ding on his phone and a text from Ajmal. Ajmal, his brother, and his parents were on a plane headed to Canada. Together, through the Canadian soldier, they had found their life, their salvation. They had got to the lone Canadian soldier who could spare their lives, and now they were coming home. Ajmal and his family were one of the lucky ones, of course. They had the right citizenship, the right documents, the right passports, when many others didn't and still don't. But on that day, they needed more than just a Canadian passport. What Ajmal needed was to summon up desperation and courage. And what Kirk knew and what Ajmal knew and came to know is that if they were going to live, if they were going to escape, they had to get the attention of that one Canadian soldier. They had to get to him. Ajmal wanted life. He wanted to live. He wanted his parents and brothers to live. And this lone soldier for them was the difference between life and possibly death. And they had done it. They had gotten to the one who could save them, rescue them, give them a second lease on life. Ajmal's story is, at its core, what so many of the stories in the Gospels are about. People desperate for life, doing anything they can to get to the one person that can give it to you. What the earliest Christians sense, what we read in these Gospel stories, what many people still today still understand and sense is that Jesus is a power, a life force that can heal and bring life where it's needed. And so here is what we believe at Nexus. We understand the teachings, stories, events, life, death, and resurrection of Jesus to be the path of life. My hunch is this: all of us here are looking for life. My guess is that what binds us here at Nexus is this common thirst, you could say, a desire, this desire to live meaningfully and purposefully and authentically. I believe what we share is a common desire to plug into the source of life and to live our days, our weeks, our years with a sense of hope, a sense of faith, an unending desire to learn to love better and more deeply. And at Nexus, that desire has us following the Jesus path, always learning, always looking for signs of life. It is as Peter says to Jesus, "You are the one who has the words of life." And yet, at the same time, while that's our path, our passion here, my passion, is to speak about Jesus in the most compelling ways I can possibly come up with, in the most compelling ways possible, because for too long, the Jesus path has been hijacked. For too long, the Jesus path has been made to feel like death, not life. The Jesus path has been robbed of its life-giving and affirming power, and at Nexus, we are in the process of stealing that back. Our desire is to speak of Jesus, his way, and his life in the most compelling ways we can think of. And that is the heartbeat of who we are. And so for those of you who have been on this journey with us for 11 full years, or those of you who have just decided to join us, whether in person or online, welcome. Our path is Jesus, and our passion is to speak about Jesus and his path in the most compelling ways we possibly can. So welcome at the beginning of season 12 to Nexus, where together we travel Jesus' compelling path. It's great to have you with us, so lace up your hiking shoes and keep your travel pack light. We have been scattered for about 18 months, but it's time to regather. It's time to get going again. I hope you will join us on the journey.